Chapter 10. Kitty writes to me that there's nothing she longs for so much as peace and solitude, Dolly said after the silence that had followed. And how is she? Better? Levin asked in agitation.
Thank God, she's quite well again. I never believed her lungs were affected.
Oh, I'm very glad, said Levin, and Dolly thought she saw something touching, helpless in his face as he said this, and looked silently into her face. "Let me ask you, Konstantin Dmitrievich," said Darya Alexandrovna, smiling her kindly and rather mocking smile.
"Why is it you're angry with Kitty?"
"I? I'm not angry with her," said Levin.
"Yes, you are angry. Why was it you didn't come to see us or them when you were in Moscow?"
"Darya Alexandrovna," he said, blushing up to the roots of his hair. "I wonder, really, that with your kind heart you don't feel this. How is it you feel no pity for me, if nothing else, when you know—"
"What do I know?"
"You know I proposed, and I was refused," said Levin, and all the tenderness he had been feeling for Kitty a minute before was replaced by a feeling of anger for the slight he had suffered.
"What makes you suppose I know?"
"Because everybody knows it."
"That's just where you're mistaken. I didn't know it, though I had guessed it was so."
"Well, now you know it."
"All I knew was that something had happened that made her dreadfully miserable, and that she begged me never to speak of it. And if she wouldn't tell me, she would certainly not speak of it to anyone else. But what did pass between you? Tell me."
"I have told you."
"When was it?"
"When I was at their house the last time."
"Do you know," said Darya Alexandrovna, "I'm awfully, awfully sorry for her. You suffer only from pride."
"Perhaps so," said Levin, but—"
She interrupted him. "But she, poor girl, I'm awfully, awfully sorry for her. Now I see it all."
"Well, Darya Alexandrovna, you must excuse me," he said, getting up. "Goodbye, Darya Alexandrovna, till we meet again."
"No, wait a minute," she said, clutching him by the sleeve. "Wait a minute. Sit down."
"Please, please don't let us talk of this," he said, sitting down, and at the same time feeling rise up and stir within his heart a hope he had believed to be buried. "If I did not like you," she said, and tears came into her eyes, "if I didn't know you as I do know you—" The feeling that had seemed dead revived more and more, rose up and took possession of Levin's heart.
"Yes, I understand it all now," said Darya Alexandrovna.
"You can't understand it. For you men who are free and make your own choice, it's always clear whom you love. But a girl's in a position of suspense, with all a woman's or maiden's modesty. A girl who sees you men from afar, who takes everything on trust. A girl may have, and often has, such a feeling that she cannot tell what to say."
"Yes, if the heart doesn't speak." "No, the heart does speak. But just consider. You men have views about a girl. You come to the house, you make friends, you criticize. You wait to see if you have found what you love, and then, when you are sure you love her, you propose."
"Well, that's not quite it."
"Anyway, you propose when your love is ripe, or when the balance has completely turned between the two you are choosing from. But a girl is not asked. She is expected to make her choice, and yet she cannot choose. She can only answer yes or no."
"Yes, to choose between me and Vronsky," thought Levin,
and the dead thing that had come to life within him died again, and only weighed on his heart and set it aching.
"Darya Alexandrovna," he said, "that's how one chooses a new dress or some purchase or other, not love. The choice has been made, and so much the better. And there can be no repeating it."
"Oh, pride, pride," said Darya Alexandrovna, as though despising him for the baseness of this feeling in comparison with that other feeling which only women know. At the time when you made Kitty an offer, she was just in a position in which she couldn't answer. She was in doubt. Doubt between you and Vronsky. She was seeing him every day, and you she hadn't seen for a long while. Supposing she'd been older. I, for instance, in her place, could have felt no doubt. I always disliked him, and so it has turned out.
Levin recalled Kitty's answer. She had said, "No, that cannot be."
"Darya Alexandrovna," he said dryly, "I appreciate your confidence in me. I believe you're making a mistake. But whether I'm right or wrong, that pride you so despise makes any thought of Katerina Alexandrovna out of the question for me. You understand? Utterly out of the question."
"I will only say one thing more. You know that I am speaking of my sister, whom I love as I love my own children. I don't say she cared for you. All I meant to say is that her refusal at that moment proves nothing."
"I don't know," said Levin, jumping up. "If you only knew how you are hurting me. It's just as if a child of yours were dead, and they were to say to you, 'He would have been like this and like that, and he might have lived, and how happy you would have been in him. But he's dead, dead, dead.'"
"How absurd you are," said Darya Alexandrovna, looking with mournful tenderness at Levin's excitement. "Yes, I see it all more and more clearly," she went on musingly. "So you won't come to see us, then, when Kitty's here?"
"No, I will not come. Of course, I won't avoid meeting Katerina Alexandrovna, but as far as I can, I will try to save her the annoyance of my presence."
"You are very, very absurd," repeated Darya Alexandrovna, looking with tenderness into his face. "Very well. Then let it be as though we had not spoken of this. What have you come in for, Tanya?" she said in French to the little girl who had come in.
"Where's my spade, Mama?"
"I speak French, and you must too." The little girl tried to say it in French, but couldn't remember the French for a spade. The mother prompted her, and then told her in French where to look for the spade. And this made a disagreeable impression on Levin. Everything in Darya Alexandrovna's house and children struck him now as by no means so charming as a little while before. "And why does she talk French with the children?" he thought. "How unnatural and false it is. And the children feel it so. Learning French and unlearning sincerity," he thought to himself, unaware that Darya Alexandrovna had thought all that over 20 times already, and yet, even at the cost of some loss of sincerity, believed it necessary to teach her children French in that way. "But why are you going? Do stay a little." Levin stayed to tea, but his good humour had vanished, and he felt ill at ease. After tea he went out into the hall to order his horses to be harnessed, and when he came back he found Darya Alexandrovna greatly disturbed, with a troubled face and tears in her eyes. While Levin had been outside, an incident had occurred which had utterly shattered the happiness she had been feeling that day, and her pride in her children. Grisha and Tanya had been fighting over a ball. Darya Alexandrovna, hearing a scream in the nursery, ran in and saw a terrible sight. Tanya was pulling Grisha's hair, while he, with a face hideous with rage, was beating her with his fists wherever he could get at her. Something snapped in Darya Alexandrovna's heart when she saw this. It was as if darkness had swooped down upon her life. She felt that these children of hers, that she was so proud of, were not merely most ordinary, but positively bad, ill-bred children, with coarse, brutal propensities, wicked children. She couldn't talk or think of anything else, and she couldn't speak to Levin of her misery. Levin saw that she was unhappy, and tried to comfort her, saying that it showed nothing bad, that all children fight. But even as he said it, he was thinking in his heart, "No, I won't be artificial and talk French with my children. But my children won't be like that. All one has to do is not spoil children, not to distort their nature, and they'll be delightful. No, my children won't be like that. He said goodbye and drove away, and she didn't try to detain him. Chapter 11. In the middle of July, the elder of the village on Levin's sister's estate, about 15 miles from Pokrovskoye, came to Levin to report on how things were going there, and on the hay. The chief source of income on his sister's estate was from the riverside meadows. In former years, the hay had been bought by the peasants for 20 rubles for every 3 acres. When Levin took over the management of the estate, he thought, on examining the grasslands, that they were worth more, and he fixed the price at 25 rubles for every 3 acres. The peasants wouldn't give that price, and, as Levin suspected, discouraged other purchasers. Then Levin had driven over himself and arranged to have the grass cut, partly by hired labour, partly at a payment of a certain proportion of the crop. His own peasants put every hindrance they could in the way of this new arrangement, but it was carried out, and the first year the meadows had yielded a profit almost double. The previous year, which was the third year, the peasants had maintained the same opposition to the arrangement, and the hay had been cut on the same system. This year the peasants were doing all the mowing for a third of the hay crop, and the village elder had come now to announce that the hay had been cut, and that, fearing rain, they had invited the estate clerk over, had divided the crop in his presence, and had raked together 11 stacks as the owner's share. From the vague answers to his question how much hay had been cut on the principal meadow, from the haste of the village elder to divide it without asking for permission, from the whole tone of the peasant, Levin perceived that there was something wrong in the division of the hay, and made up his mind to drive over himself to look into the matter. Arriving for dinner at the village, and leaving his horse at the cottage of an old friend of his, the husband of his brother's wet nurse, Levin went to see the old man at his apiary, wanting to find out from him the truth about the hay. Parmenich, a talkative, stately old man, gave Levin a very warm welcome, showed him all he was doing, told him everything about his bees and the swarms of that year, but gave vague and unwilling answers to Levin's inquiries about the mowing. This confirmed Levin still more in his suspicions. He went to the hayfields and examined the stacks. The haystacks couldn't possibly contain 50 wagon loads each, and to convict the peasants, Levin ordered the wagons that had carried the hay to be brought at once, to lift one stack and carry it into the barn. There turned out to be only 32 loads in the stack. In spite of the village elder's assertions about the compressibility of hay and its having settled down in the stacks, and his swearing that everything had been done in the fear of God, Levin stuck to his point that the hay had been divided without his orders, and that therefore he would not accept that hay as 50 loads to a stack. After a prolonged dispute, the matter was decided by the peasants taking these 11 stacks, counting them as 50 loads each. The arguments and the division of the haycocks lasted the whole afternoon. When the last of the hay had been divided, Levin, entrusting the superintendence of the rest to the clerk, sat down on a haycock marked off by a stake of willow, and looked admiringly at the meadows swarming with peasants. In front of him, in the bend of the river beyond the marsh, moved a bright-coloured line of peasant women, and the scattered hay was being rapidly formed into grey, winding rows over the pale green stubble. After the women came the men with pitchforks, and from the grey rows there were growing up broad, high, soft haycocks. To the left, carts were rumbling over the meadow that had already been cleared, and one after another the haycocks vanished, flung up in huge forkfuls, and in their place there were rising heavy cartloads of fragrant hay hanging over the horses' hindquarters.
"What weather for haying! What hay it'll be!" said an old man squatting down beside Levin. "It's tea, not hay. It's like scattering grain to the ducks the way they pick it up," he added, pointing to the growing haycocks. "Since dinner-time they've carried a good half of it. The last load, eh?"
he shouted to a young peasant who drove by, standing in the front of an empty cart, shaking the cord reins.
"The last, Dad!"
the lad shouted back, pulling in the horse, and smiling,
He looked around at a bright, rosy-cheeked peasant girl who sat in the cart smiling too and drove on. "Who's that, your son?" asked Levin.
"My baby," said the old man with a tender smile.
"What a fine fellow."
"The boy's all right."
"Married already?"
"Yes, it's 2 years last St. Philip's fast."
"Any children?"
"Children, indeed. Why, for over a year he was as innocent as a babe himself, and bashful too," answered the old man. "Well, the hay, it's as fragrant as tea," he repeated, wishing to change the subject.
Levin looked more attentively at Ivan Parmenov and his wife. They were loading a haycock onto the cart not far from him. Ivan Parmenov was standing on the cart, taking, laying in place, and stamping down the huge bundles of hay which his pretty young wife deftly handed up to him, at first in armfuls, and then on the pitchfork. The young wife worked easily, merrily, and dexterously. The close-packed hay did not at once break away off her fork. First she gathered it together, stuck the fork into it, then with a rapid, supple movement leaned the whole weight of her body on it, and at once, with a bend of her back under the red belt, she drew herself up, and arching her full bosom under the white smock, with a smart turn, she swung the fork in her arms and flung the bundle of hay high onto the cart. Ivan, obviously doing his best to save her every minute of unnecessary labour, made haste, opening wide his arms, to clutch the bundle and lay it in the cart. As she raked together what was left of the hay, the young wife shook off the bits of hay that had fallen on her neck, and straightening the red kerchief that had dropped forward over her white brow, not browned like her face by the sun, she crept under the cart to tie up the load. Ivan directed her how to fasten the cord to the crosspiece, and at something she said he laughed aloud. In the expressions of both faces was to be seen vigorous, young, freshly awakened love. Chapter 12. The load was tied on. Ivan jumped down and took the quiet, sleek horse by the bridle. The young wife flung the rake up on the load, and with a bold step, swinging her arms, she went to join the women who were forming a ring for the haymakers' dance. Ivan drove off to the road and fell into line with the other loaded carts. The peasant women, with their rakes on their shoulders, gay with bright flowers, and chattering with ringing, merry voices, walked behind the cart. One wild, untrained female voice broke into a song, and sang it alone through a verse, and then the same verse was taken up and repeated by half a hundred strong, healthy voices of all sorts, coarse and fine, singing in unison. The women, all singing, began to come close to Levin, and he felt as though a storm was swooping down upon him with a thunder of merriment. The storm swooped down, enveloped him, and the haycock on which he was lying, and the other haycocks and the carts and the whole meadow and distant fields all seemed to be shaking and singing to the measures of this wild, merry song, with its shouts and whistles and clapping. Levin felt envious of this health and mirthfulness. He longed to take part in the expression of this joy of life. But he could do nothing, and had to lie and look on and listen. When the peasants with their singing had vanished out of sight and hearing, a weary feeling of despondency at his own isolation, his physical inactivity, his alienation from this world came over Levin. Some of the very peasants who had been most active in wrangling with him over the hay, some whom he had treated with contempt and who had tried to cheat him, those very peasants had greeted him cheerfully, and evidently had not, were incapable of having any feeling of rancour against him, any regret, any recollection even of having tried to deceive him. All that was drowned in a sea of merry common labour. God gave the day, God gave the strength. And the day and the strength were consecrated to labour, and that labour was its own reward. For whom the labour? What would be its fruits? These were idle considerations, beside the point. Often Levin had admired this life, often he had a sense of envy of the men who led this life. But today, for the first time, especially under the influence of what he had seen in the attitude of Ivan Parmenov towards his young wife, The idea presented itself definitely to his mind that it was in his power to exchange the dreary, artificial, idle, and individualistic life he was leading for this laborious, pure, and delightful life. The old man who had been sitting beside him had long ago gone home. The people had all separated. Those who lived near had gone home, while those who came from far were gathered into a group for supper and to spend the night in the meadow. Levin, unobserved by the peasants, still lay on the haycock, and still looked on and listened and mused. The peasants who remained for the night in the meadow scarcely slept the whole short summer night. At first there was the sound of merry talk and laughter all together over the supper, then singing again and laughter. The whole long day of toil had left no trace in them but lightness of heart. Before the early dawn, all was hushed. Nothing was to be heard but the night sounds of the frogs that never ceased in the marsh, and the horses snorting in the mist that rose over the meadow before the morning. Rousing himself, Levin got up from the haycock, and looking at the stars, he saw that the night was over. "Well, what am I going to do? How am I to do it?" he said to himself, trying to express to himself all the thoughts and feelings he had passed through in that brief night. All the thoughts and feelings he had passed through fell into three separate trains of thought. One was the renunciation of his old life, of his utterly useless education. This renunciation gave him satisfaction and was easy and simple. Another series of thoughts and mental images related to the life he longed to live now. The simplicity, the purity, the sanity of this life he felt clearly, and he was convinced he would find in it the content, the peace, and the dignity, of the lack of which he was so miserably conscious. But a third series of ideas turned upon the question of how to effect this transition from the old life to the new. And there nothing took clear shape for him. Have a wife. Have work and the necessity of work. Leave Pokrovskoye, buy land, become a member of a peasant community, marry a peasant girl. How am I to do it? He asked himself again, and couldn't find an answer. I haven't slept all night, though, and I can't think it out clearly, he said to himself. I'll work it out later. One thing's certain. This night has decided my fate. All my old dreams of married life were absurd, not the real thing, he told himself. It's all really so much simpler and better. How beautiful, he thought, looking at the strange mother-of-pearl shell of white, fleecy cloudlets resting right over his head in the middle of the sky. How exquisite it all is in this exquisite night. And when was there time for that cloud shell to form? Just now I looked at the sky and there was nothing in it, only two white streaks. Yes, and so imperceptibly, too, my views of life changed. He went out of the meadow and walked along the road toward the village. A slight wind arose, and the sky looked grey and sullen. The gloomy moment that usually precedes the dawn had come, the full triumph of light over darkness. Shrinking from the cold, Levin walked rapidly, looking at the ground. "What's that? Someone coming?" he thought, catching the tinkle of bells and lifting his head. 40 paces from him, a carriage with 4 horses harnessed abreast was driving toward him along the grassy road on which he was walking. The shaft horses were tilted against the shafts by the ruts, but the dexterous driver, sitting on the box, held the shaft over the ruts so that the wheels ran on the smooth part of the road. This was all Levin noticed, and without wondering who it could be, he gazed absently at the coach. In the coach was an old lady dozing in one corner, and at the window, evidently only just awake, sat a young girl holding in both hands the ribbons of a white cap. With a face full of light and thought, full of a subtle, complex inner life that was remote from Levin, she was gazing beyond him at the glow of the sunrise. At that very instant, when this apparition was vanishing, the truthful eyes glanced at him. She recognized him, and her face lighted up with amazed delight. He couldn't be mistaken. There were no other eyes like those in the world. There was only one creature in the world who could concentrate for him all the brightness and meaning of life. It was she. It was Kitty. He understood that she was driving to Yugushava from the railway station, and everything that had been stirring Levin during that sleepless night, all the resolutions he had made, all vanished at once. He recalled with horror his dreams of marrying a peasant girl. Only there, in the carriage that had crossed over to the other side of the road and was rapidly disappearing, only there could he find the solution to the riddle of his life, which had weighed so agonizingly upon him of late. She didn't look out again. The sound of the carriage springs was no longer audible. The bells could scarcely be heard. The barking of dogs indicated that the carriage had reached the village, and all that was left were the empty fields all around, the village in front, and he himself isolated and apart from it all, wandering lonely along the deserted road. He glanced at the sky, expecting to find there the cloud shell he had been admiring and taking as the symbol of the ideas and feelings of that night. There was nothing in the sky in the least like a shell. There, in the remote heights above, a mysterious change had been accomplished. There was no trace of a shell, and there was, stretched over fully half the sky, an even cover of tiny and ever tinier cloudlets. The sky had grown blue and bright, and with the same softness, but with the same remoteness it met his questioning gaze. "No," he said to himself, "however good that life of simplicity and toil may be, I cannot go back to it. I love her." Chapter 13. None but those who were most intimate with Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin knew that while on the surface the coldest and most reasonable of men, he had one weakness quite opposed to the general trend of his character. Alexei Alexandrovich couldn't hear or see a child or woman crying without being moved. The sight of tears threw him into a state of nervous agitation, and he utterly lost all power of reflection. The chief secretary of his department and his private secretary were aware of this, and used to warn women who came with petitions on no account to give way to tears if they didn't want to ruin their chances. "He will get angry and won't listen to you," they used to say. And, as a fact, in such cases, the emotional disturbance set up in Alexei Alexandrovich by the sight of tears found expression in hasty anger. "I can do nothing. Kindly leave the room," he would commonly cry in such cases. When returning from the races, Anna had informed him of her relations with Vronsky, and immediately afterward had burst into tears, hiding her face in her hands. Alexei Alexandrovich, for all the fury aroused in him against her, was aware at the same time of a rush of that emotional disturbance always produced in him by tears. Conscious of it, and conscious that any expression of his feelings at that minute would be out of keeping with the situation, he tried to suppress every manifestation of life in himself, and so neither stirred nor looked at her. This was what had caused that strange expression of death-like rigidity in his face, which had so impressed Anna. When they reached the house, he helped her to get out of the carriage, and making an effort to master himself, he took leave of her with his usual urbanity, and uttered that phrase that bound him to nothing. He said that tomorrow he would let her know his decision. His wife's words, confirming his worst suspicions, had sent a cruel pang to the heart of Alexei Alexandrovich. That pang was intensified by the strange feeling of physical pity for her, set up by her tears. But when he was all alone in the carriage, Alexei Alexandrovich, to his surprise and delight, felt complete relief both from this pity and from the doubts and agonies of jealousy. He experienced the sensations of a man who has had a tooth out after suffering long from toothache. After a fearful agony and a sense of something huge, bigger than the head itself, being torn out of his jaw, the sufferer, hardly able to believe in his own good luck, feels all at once that what has so long poisoned his existence and enslaved his attention exists no longer, and that he can live and think again, and take interest in other things besides his tooth. This feeling Alexei Alexandrovich was experiencing. The agony had been strange and terrible, but now it was over, he felt that he could live again and think of something other than his wife. "No honour, no heart, no religion. A corrupt woman. I always knew it, and always saw it, though I tried to deceive myself to spare her, he said to himself. And it actually seemed to him that he always had seen it. He recalled incidents of their past life, in which he'd never seen anything wrong before. Now, these incidents proved clearly that she had always been a corrupt woman.
I made a mistake in linking my life to hers, but there was nothing reprehensible in my mistake, and so I cannot be unhappy.
It's not that I'm to blame, he told himself, but she.
But I have nothing to do with her. She doesn't exist for me.
Everything relating to her and her son, toward whom his sentiments were as much changed as toward her, ceased to interest him. The only thing that interested him now was the question of what way he could best, with most propriety and comfort for himself, and so with most justice, extricate himself from the mud with which she had spattered him in her fall, and then proceed along his path of active, honourable, and useful existence.
I cannot be made unhappy by the fact that a contemptible woman has committed a crime. I've only to find the best way out of the difficult position in which she has placed me, and I shall find it, he said to himself, frowning more and more. I'm not the first or the last.
And to say nothing of historical instances dating from the Menelaus and La Belle Hélène, recently revived in the memory of all, a whole list of contemporary examples of husbands with unfaithful wives in the highest society rose before Alexei Alexandrovitch's imagination.
Taryalov, Potavsky, Prince Karibanov, Count Paskudin, Dram. Yes, even Dram, such an honest, capable fellow.
Semyonov, Shagin, Sigonin, Alexei Alexandrovitch remembered.
Admitting that a certain, quite unreasonable ridicule falls to the lot of these men, yet I never saw anything but a misfortune in it, and always felt sympathy for it,
he said to himself. Though indeed this was not the fact, and he had never felt sympathy for misfortunes of that kind. But the more frequently he had heard of instances of unfaithful wives betraying their husbands, the more highly he had thought of himself.
It's a misfortune that may befall anyone. And this misfortune has befallen me. The only thing to be done is to make the best of the situation.
And he began mentally reviewing the course of action taken by men who had been in the same position that he was in.
Taryalov fought a duel.
The duel had particularly fascinated the thoughts of Alexei Alexandrovitch in his youth, just because he was physically a coward, and was himself well aware of the fact. Alexei Alexandrovitch could not without horror contemplate the idea of a pistol aimed at himself, and never made use of any weapon in his life. This horror had, in his youth, started him pondering on dueling, and picturing himself in a position in which he would have to expose his life to danger. Having attained success and an established position in the world, he had long ago forgotten this feeling, but the old habit reasserted itself, and the dread of his own cowardice proved even now so strong that Alexei Alexandrovitch spent a long while thinking over the question of dueling in all its aspects, and playing with the idea of a duel, though he was fully aware beforehand that he would never, under any circumstances, fight one.
There's no doubt our society is still so barbarous. It's not the same in England, that very many,
and among these were those whose opinion Alexei Alexandrovitch particularly valued,
look favourably on the duel. But what result is attained by it? Suppose I challenge him,
Alexei Alexandrovitch went on to himself, and vividly picturing the night he would spend after the challenge and the pistol aimed at him, he shuddered, and knew that he never would do it.
Suppose I challenge him. Suppose I am taught, he went on musing, to shoot. I press the trigger, he said to himself, closing his eyes. And it turns out I've killed him.
And he shook his head as though to dispel such silly ideas.
What sense is there in murdering a man in order to define one's relation to a guilty wife and son? I would still just as much have to decide what I ought to do with her. But what is more probable, and what would doubtless occur, I would be killed or wounded. I, the innocent person, would be the victim, killed or wounded. It's even more senseless. But apart from that, a challenge to fight would be an act hardly honest on my side. Don't I know perfectly well that my friends would never allow me to fight a duel, would never allow the life of a statesman needed by Russia to be exposed to danger. Knowing perfectly well beforehand that the matter would never come to real danger, it would amount to my simply trying to gain a certain false glory by such a challenge. That would be dishonest. That would be false. That would be deceiving myself and others. A duel is quite unreasonable, and no one expects it of me. My aim is simply to safeguard my reputation, which is essential for the uninterrupted pursuit of my public duties.
Official duties, which had always been of great consequence in Alexei Alexandrovitch's eyes, seemed of special importance to his mind at this moment. Considering and rejecting the duel, Alexei Alexandrovitch turned to divorce, another solution selected by several of the husbands he remembered. Passing in mental review all the instances he knew of divorce, there were plenty of them in the very highest society with which he was very familiar, Alexei Alexandrovitch couldn't find a single example in which the object of divorce was that which he had in view. In all these instances, the husband had practically ceded or sold his unfaithful wife, and the very party which, being in fault, had not the right to contract a fresh marriage, had formed counterfeit, pseudo-matrimonial ties with a self-styled husband. In his own case, Alexei Alexandrovitch saw that a legal divorce, that is to say, one in which only the guilty wife would be repudiated, was impossible to get. He saw that the complex conditions of the life they led made the coarse proofs of his wife's guilt required by the law out of the question. He saw that a certain refinement in that life would not admit of such proofs being brought forward, even if he had them, and that to bring forward such proofs would damage him in the public estimation more than it would her. An attempt at divorce could lead to nothing but a public scandal, which would be a perfect godsend to his enemies for calumny and attacks on his high position in society. His chief object, to define the position with the least amount of disturbance possible, would not be attained by divorce either. Moreover, in the event of divorce, or even of an attempt to obtain a divorce, it was obvious that the wife broke off all relations with the husband and threw in her lot with the lover. And in spite of the complete, as he supposed, contempt and indifference he now felt for his wife, at the bottom of his heart, Alexei Alexandrovitch still had one feeling left in regard to her. A disinclination to see her free to throw in her lot with Vronsky, so that her crime would be to her advantage. The mere notion of this so exasperated him that as soon as it occurred to him, he groaned with inward agony, and got up and changed his place in the carriage. And for a long while after, he sat with scowling brows, wrapping his numbed and bony legs in the fleecy blanket.
Apart from formal divorce, one might still do like Karibanov, Paskudin, and that good fellow Dram, that is, separate from one's wife, he went on thinking when he had regained his composure. But this step also presented the same drawback of public scandal as a divorce, and what was more, a separation, quite as much as a regular divorce, flung his wife into the arms of Vronsky. No, it's out of the question, out of the question, he said again, twisting his blanket tighter about him. I cannot be unhappy, but neither she nor he ought to be happy.
The feeling of jealousy which had tortured him during the period of uncertainty had passed away at the instant when the tooth had been with agony extracted by his wife's words. But that feeling had been replaced by another, the desire not merely that she should not be triumphant, but that she should get due retribution for her crime. He didn't acknowledge this feeling, but deep in his heart he longed for her to suffer for having destroyed his peace of mind, his honour. And going over again the conditions inseparable from a duel, a divorce, a separation, and once again rejecting them, Alexei Alexandrovitch felt convinced that there was only one solution, to keep her with him, concealing what had happened from the world, and using every measure in his power to break off the intrigue, and still more, though this he didn't admit to himself, to punish her.
I must inform her of my conclusion that, thinking over the terrible situation in which she has placed her family, all other solutions will be worse for both sides than an external status quo, and that such I agree to retain on the strict condition of obedience on her part to my wishes, that is to say, cessation of all intercourse with her lover.
When this decision had been finally adopted, another weighty consideration occurred to Alexei Alexandrovitch in support of it.
"By only such a course shall I be acting in accordance with the dictates of religion," he told himself. "In adopting this course, I'm not casting off a guilty wife, but giving her a chance of amendment. And indeed, difficult as the task will be to me, I shall devote part of my energies to her reformation and salvation."
Though Alexei Alexandrovitch was perfectly aware that he couldn't exert any moral influence over his wife, that such an attempt at reformation could lead to nothing but lies, though in passing through these difficult moments he had not once thought of seeking guidance in religion, yet now, when his conclusion corresponded, as it seemed to him, with the requirements of religion, this religious sanction to his decision gave him complete satisfaction, and to some extent restored his peace of mind. He was pleased to think that even in such an important crisis in life, no one would be able to say that he had not acted in accordance with the principles of that religion whose banner he had always held aloft amid the general apathy and indifference. As he pondered over subsequent developments, Alexei Alexandrovitch didn't see, indeed, why his relations with his wife should not remain practically the same as before. No doubt she could never regain his esteem, but there was not, and there could not be, any sort of reason that his existence should be troubled, and that he should suffer because she was a bad and faithless wife.
"Yes, time will pass, time which arranges all things, and the old relations will be restored," Alexei Alexandrovitch told himself. "So far restored, that is, that I shall not be sensible of a break in the continuity of my life. She is bound to be unhappy, but I'm not to blame, so I cannot be unhappy."
Chapter 14. As he neared Petersburg, Alexei Alexandrovitch not only adhered entirely to his decision, he even composed in his head the letter he would write to his wife. Going into the porter's room, he glanced at the letters and papers brought him from his office, and directed that they should be brought to him in his study.
"The horses can be unharnessed, and I will see no one," he said, in answer to the porter, with a certain pleasure indicative of his agreeable frame of mind, emphasizing the words, "see no one."
In his study, Alexei Alexandrovitch walked up and down twice, and stopped at an immense writing-table on which 6 candles had already been lighted by the valet who had preceded him. He cracked his knuckles and sat down, sorting out his writing materials. Putting his elbows on the table, he cocked his head to one side, thought a minute, and began to write without pausing for a second. He wrote without directly addressing her, and used French, making use of the plural vous, which is not the same note of coldness as the corresponding Russian form.
"At our last conversation, I notified you of my intention to communicate to you my decision in regard to the subject of that conversation. Having carefully considered everything, I'm writing now with the object of fulfilling that promise. My decision is as follows. Whatever your conduct may have been, I do not consider myself justified in breaking the ties in which we are bound by a higher power. The family cannot be broken up by a whim, a caprice, or even by the sin of one of the partners in the marriage, and our life must go on as it has in the past. This is essential for me, for you, and for our son. I'm fully convinced that you have repented, and do repent, of what has called forth the present letter, and that you will cooperate with me in eradicating the cause of our estrangement and forgetting the past. In the contrary event, you can conjecture what awaits you and your son. All this I hope to discuss more in detail in a personal interview. As the summer season is drawing to a close, I would beg you to return to Petersburg as quickly as possible, not later than Tuesday. All necessary preparations shall be made for your arrival here. I beg you to note that I attach particular significance to compliance with this request.
A. Karenin.
P.S. I enclose the money which may be needed for your expenses.
He read the letter through and felt pleased with it, and especially that he had remembered to enclose money. There was not a harsh word nor a reproach in it, nor was there undue indulgence. Most of all, it was a golden bridge for return. Folding the letter and smoothing it with a massive ivory knife, and putting it in an envelope with the money,
He rang the bell with the gratification it always afforded him to use the well-arranged appointments of his writing-table.
"Give this to the courier, to be delivered to Anna Arkadyevna tomorrow at the summer villa,"
he said, getting up.
"Certainly, Your Excellency. Tea to be served in the study?"
Alexei Alexandrovitch ordered tea to be brought to the study, and playing with a massive paper-knife, he moved to his armchair, near which there had been placed ready for him a lamp, and the French work on the Agubium tables that he had begun. Over the armchair there hung in a gold frame an oval portrait of Anna, a fine painting by a celebrated artist. Alexei Alexandrovitch glanced at it. The unfathomable eyes gazed ironically and insolently at him. Insufferably insolent and challenging was the effect, in Alexei Alexandrovitch's eyes, of the black lace about the head admirably done by the painter, the black hair and handsome white hand, with one finger lifted, covered with rings. After looking at the portrait for a minute, Alexei Alexandrovitch shuddered so that his lips quivered and uttered the sound, "Pfft," and turned away. He made haste to sit down in his armchair and opened the book. He tried to read, but he couldn't revive the very vivid interest he had felt before in Agubium inscriptions. He looked at the book and thought of something else. He thought not of his wife, but of a complication that had arisen in his official life, which at the time constituted the chief interest of it. He felt that he had penetrated more deeply than ever before into this intricate affair, and that he had originated a leading idea, he could say it without self-flattery, calculated to clear up the whole business, to strengthen him in his official career, to discomfit his enemies, and thereby to be of the greatest benefit to the government. As soon as the servant had set the tea and left the room, Alexei Alexandrovitch got up and went to the writing-table. Moving a portfolio of papers into the middle of the table, with a scarcely perceptible smile of self-satisfaction, he took a pencil from a rack and plunged into the perusal of a complex report relating to the present complication. The complication was of this nature. Alexei Alexandrovitch's characteristic quality as a politician, that special individual qualification that every rising functionary possesses, the qualification that, with his unflagging ambition, his reserve, his honesty, and his self-confidence had made his career, was his contempt for red tape, his cutting down of correspondence, his direct contact, whenever possible, with the living fact, and his economy. It happened that the famous commission of the 2nd of June had set on foot an inquiry into the irrigation of lands in the Zarayski province, which fell under Alexei Alexandrovich's department, and was a glaring example of fruitless expenditure and red tape. Alexei Alexandrovich was aware of the truth of this. The irrigation of these lands in the Zarayski province had been initiated by the predecessor of Alexei Alexandrovich's predecessor. And vast sums of money had actually been spent and were still being spent on this business, and utterly unproductively, and the whole business could obviously lead to nothing whatever. Alexei Alexandrovich had perceived this at once on entering office, and would have liked to lay hands on the Board of Irrigation. But at first, when he did not yet feel secure in his position, he knew it would affect too many interests and would be injudicious. Later on he'd been engrossed in other questions and had simply forgotten the Board of Irrigation. It went on by itself, like all such boards, by the mere force of inertia. Many people gained their livelihood by the Board of Irrigation, especially one highly conscientious and musical family. All the daughters played stringed instruments, and Alexei Alexandrovich knew the family and had sponsored one of the elder daughters at her wedding. The raising of this question by a hostile department was, in Alexei Alexandrovich's opinion, a dishonourable proceeding, seeing that in every department there were things similar, and worse, which no one inquired into, for well-known reasons of official etiquette. However, now that the gauntlet had been thrown down, he had boldly picked it up and demanded the appointment of a special commission to investigate and verify the working of the Board of Irrigation of the lands in the Zarayski province. But in compensation, he gave no quarter to the enemy either. He demanded the appointment of another special commission to inquire into the question of regulating the affairs of the native population. The question of regulating the affairs of the native population had been brought up incidentally in the commission of the 2nd of June, and had been pressed forward actively by Alexei Alexandrovitch as one admitting of no delay on account of the deplorable condition of the natives. In the commission, this question had been a ground of contention between several departments. The department hostile to Alexei Alexandrovitch proved that the condition of the natives was exceedingly flourishing, that the proposed reconstruction might be the ruin of their prosperity, and that if there was anything wrong, it arose mainly from the failure on the part of Alexei Alexandrovitch's department to carry out the measures prescribed by law. Now, Alexei Alexandrovitch intended to demand, first, that a new commission should be formed, which should be empowered to investigate the condition of the natives on the spot. Second, if it should turn out that the condition of the natives actually was such as it appeared to be from the official documents in the hands of the committee, that another new scientific commission should be appointed to investigate the deplorable condition of the natives from the 1. Political, 2. Administrative, 3. Economic, 4. Ethnographical, 5. Material, and 6. Religious points of view. Third, that evidence should be required from the rival department of the measures that had been taken during the last 10 years by that department for averting the disastrous conditions in which the natives were now placed. And fourth, and finally, that that department be asked to explain why it had, as appeared from the evidence before the committee, from number 17,015 and 18,308, from December the 5th, 1863, and June the 7th, 1864, acted in direct contravention of the intention of the law, volume Act 18, and the footnote to Act 36. A flash of eagerness suffused the face of Alexei Alexandrovitch as he rapidly wrote out a synopsis of these ideas for his own benefit. Having filled a sheet of paper, he got up, rang, and sent a note to the chief secretary of his department to look up certain necessary facts for him. Getting up and walking about the room, he glanced again at the portrait, frowned, and smiled contemptuously. After reading a little more of the book on Yugubium inscriptions and renewing his interest in it, Alexei Alexandrovitch went to bed at 11 o'clock, and recollecting as he lay in bed the incident with his wife, he no longer saw it in such a gloomy light. Chapter 15. Though Anna had obstinately and with exasperation contradicted Vronsky when he told her her position was impossible, and tried to convince her to tell everything to her husband, at the bottom of her heart she regarded her own position as false and dishonourable, and she longed with her whole soul to change it. On the way home from the races she had told her husband the truth in a moment of excitement, and in spite of the agony she had suffered in doing so, she was glad of it. After her husband had left her, she told herself that she was glad, that now everything was out in the open, and at least there would be no more lying and deception. It seemed to her beyond doubt that her position was now made clear for ever. It might be bad, this new position, but it would be clear. There would be no indefiniteness or falsehood about it. The pain she had caused herself and her husband in uttering those words would be rewarded now by everything being made clear, she thought. That evening she saw Vronsky, but she didn't tell him of what had passed between her and her husband, though, to make the position clear, it would have been necessary to tell him. When she awakened the next morning, the first thing that came to her mind was what she had said to her husband, and this seemed to her so awful that she couldn't conceive now how she could have brought herself to utter those strange, coarse words, and couldn't imagine what would come of it. But the words were spoken, and Alexei Alexandrovitch had gone away without saying anything. "I saw Vronsky and didn't tell him. At the very instant he was going away, I wanted to call him back and tell him, but I changed my mind because it was strange that I hadn't told him the first minute. Why was it I wanted to tell him and didn't tell him?" And in answer to this question, a burning blush of shame spread over her face. She knew what had kept her from it. She knew that she had been ashamed. Her position, which had seemed to her clear the night before, suddenly struck her now as not only not simple, but as absolutely hopeless.
She felt terrified at the disgrace, of which she had not ever thought before. As soon as she thought of what her husband would do, the most terrible ideas came to her mind. She had a vision of being turned out of the house, of her shame being proclaimed to the whole world. She asked herself where she could go when she was turned out of the house, and she couldn't find an answer. When she thought of Vronsky, it seemed to her that he didn't love her, that he was already beginning to be tired of her, that she couldn't offer herself to him, and she felt bitter against him for it. It seemed to her that the words that she had spoken to her husband and had continually repeated in her imagination she had said to everyone, and everyone had heard them. She couldn't bring herself to look those of her own household in the face. She couldn't bring herself to call her maid, and still less go downstairs and see her son and his governess. The maid, who'd been listening at her door for a long while, came into her room of her own accord. Anna glanced inquiringly into her face and blushed with fear. The maid begged her pardon for coming in, saying that she thought the bell rang. She brought her clothes and a note. The note was from Betsy. Betsy reminded her that Liza Mikhailova and Baroness Stoltz were coming to play croquet with her that morning, with their admirers Kolushki and old Stremov.
"Come, if only as a study in mores. I shall expect you," she finished.
Anna read the note and heaved a deep sigh.
"Nothing. I need nothing," she said to Anushka,
who was rearranging the bottles and brushes on the dressing table.
"You can go. I'll dress at once and come down."
"I need nothing." Anushka went out, but Anna didn't begin dressing, and sat in the same position, her head and hands hanging listlessly, and every now and then she shivered all over, seemed as though she would make some gesture, utter some word, and sank back into lifelessness again. She repeated continually, "My God, my God," but neither God nor my had any meaning to her. The idea of seeking help in her difficulty in religion was as remote from her as seeking help from Alexei Alexandrovitch himself, although she had never had any doubts of the faith in which she had been brought up. She knew that the support of religion was possible only upon condition of renouncing what made up for her the whole meaning of life. She was not simply miserable. She began to feel alarm at the new emotional condition, never experienced before, in which she found herself. She felt as though everything was beginning to be doubled in her soul, just as objects sometimes appear doubled to overtired eyes. She hardly knew at times what it was she feared and what she hoped for. Whether she feared or desired what had happened, or what was going to happen, and exactly what she longed for, she couldn't have said. "Oh, what am I doing?" she said to herself, feeling a sudden thrill of pain in both sides of her head. When she came to herself, she saw that she was holding her hair in both hands, each side of her temples, and pulling it. She jumped up and began walking about.
"The coffee is ready, and Mamselle and Seryozha are waiting," said Anushka, coming back again and finding Anna in the same position.
"Seryozha? What about Seryozha?" Anna asked with sudden eagerness, recollecting her son's existence for the first time that morning.
"He's been naughty, I think," answered Anushka with a smile.
"In what way?"
"Some peaches were lying on the table in the corner room. I think he slipped in and ate one of them on the sly."
The recollection of her son suddenly roused Anna from the helpless condition in which she found herself. She recalled the partly sincere, though greatly exaggerated, role of the mother living for her child, which she had taken up of late years, and she felt with joy that in the plight in which she found herself she had a support quite apart from her relation to her husband or to Vronsky. This support was her son. In whatever position she might be placed, she couldn't lose her son. Her husband might put her to shame and turn her out. Vronsky might grow cold to her and go on living his own life apart. She thought of him again with bitterness and reproach. She could not leave her son. She had an aim in life, and she must act. Act to secure this relation to her son so that he might not be taken from her. Quickly, indeed, as quickly as possible, she must take action before he was taken from her. She must take her son and go away. Here was the one thing she had to do now. She needed consolation. She must be calm and get out of this insufferable position. The thought of immediate action, binding her to her son, of going away somewhere with him, gave her this consolation. She dressed quickly, went downstairs, and with resolute steps walked into the drawing-room, where she found, as usual, waiting for her, the coffee, Seryozha, and his governess. Seryozha, all in white, with his back and head bent, was standing at a table under a mirror, and with an expression of intense concentration which she knew well, and in which he resembled his father, he was doing something to the flowers he carried. The governess had a particularly severe expression. Seryozha screamed shrilly, as he often did,
"Oh, Mama!"
and stopped, hesitating, whether to go to greet his mother and put down the flowers, or to finish making the wreath and go with the flowers. The governess, after saying good morning, began a long and detailed account of Seryozha's naughtiness. But Anna didn't hear her. She was considering whether she should take her with her or not. "No, I won't take her," she decided. "I'll go alone with my child." "Yes, it's very wrong," said Anna, and taking her son by the shoulder, she looked at him, not severely, but with a timid glance that bewildered and delighted the boy, and she kissed him. "Leave him to me," she said to the astonished governess, and not letting go of her son, she sat down at the table where coffee was set ready for her.
"Mama, I didn't," he said,
trying to make out from her expression what was in store for him in regard to the peaches.
"Seryozha," she said, as soon as the governess had left the room, "that was wrong. But you'll never do it again, will you? You love me."
She felt that the tears were coming into her eyes. "Can I help loving him?" she said to herself, looking deeply into his scared and at the same time delighted eyes. "And can he ever join his father in punishing me? Is it possible he will not feel for me?" Tears were already flowing down her face, and to hide them she got up abruptly and almost ran out onto the terrace. After the thunder-showers of the last few days, cold, bright weather had set in. The air was cold in the bright sun that filtered through the freshly washed leaves. She shivered, both from the cold and from the inward horror which had clutched her with fresh force in the open air.
Run along to Mariette," she said to Seryozha, who had followed her out,
and she began walking up and down on the straw matting of the terrace.
"Can it be that they won't forgive me, won't understand how it all couldn't be helped?" she said to herself.
Standing still, and looking at the tops of the aspen trees waving in the wind with their freshly washed, brightly shining leaves in the cold sunshine, she knew that they wouldn't forgive her, that everyone and everything would be merciless to her now, as was that sky, that green. And again she felt that everything was split in two in her soul.
"I mustn't think," she said to herself. "I must get ready. To go where? When? Whom to take with me? Yes, to Moscow by the evening train. Annushka and Seryozha, and only the most necessary things. But first, I must write to them both."
She went quickly indoors into her boudoir, sat down at the table, and wrote to her husband. "After what has happened, I cannot remain any longer in your house. I'm going away and taking my son with me. I don't know the law, and so I don't know with which of the parents the son should remain. But I take him with me because I cannot live without him. Be generous. Leave him to me." Up to this point she wrote rapidly and naturally, but the appeal to his generosity, a quality she didn't recognize in him, and the necessity of concluding the letter with something touching, made her stop. "Of my fault and my remorse I cannot speak, because—" She stopped again, finding no connection in her ideas. "No," she said to herself, "this is unnecessary." And tearing up the letter, she wrote it again, leaving out the allusion to generosity, and sealed it. Another letter had to be written, to Vronsky. "I've told my husband," she wrote, and she sat a long while unable to write more. It was so coarse, so unfeminine.
And what more am I to write him? She said to herself. Again, a flush of shame spread over her face. She recalled his composure, and a feeling of anger against him impelled her to tear the sheet with the phrase she had written into tiny bits.
No need to write anything, she said to herself.
And closing her blotting pad, she went upstairs, told the governess and the servants that she was going that day to Moscow, and at once began to pack her things. Chapter 16 All the rooms of the summer villa were full of porters, gardeners, and footmen, going to and fro, carrying out things. Cupboards and chests were open. Twice they had sent to the shop for cord. Pieces of newspaper were tossing about on the floor. Two trunks, some bags, and strapped-up rugs had been carried down into the hall. The carriage and two hired cabs were waiting at the steps. Anna, forgetting her inward agitation in the work of packing, was standing at a table in her boudoir, packing her travelling bag, when Anushka called her attention to the rattle of a carriage driving up. Anna looked out of the window and saw Alexei Alexandrovitch's courier on the steps, ringing at the front doorbell. "Run and find out what it is," she said, and with a calm sense of being prepared for anything, she sat down in an armchair, folding her hands on her knees. A footman brought in a thick envelope addressed in Alexei Alexandrovitch's writing. "The courier had orders to wait for an answer," he said. "Very well," she said. And as soon as he had left the room, she tore open the letter with trembling fingers. A roll of unfolded notes done up in a wrapper fell out of it. She took out the letter and began reading it at the end. "Preparations shall be made for your arrival here. I attach particular significance to compliance," she read. Then, going back, she read it all through twice from the beginning. When she had finished, she felt that she was cold all over, and that a fearful calamity, such as she had not expected, had burst upon her. In the morning she had regretted that she had spoken to her husband, and wished for nothing so much as that those words could be unspoken. And here, this letter regarded them as unspoken, and gave her what she had wanted. But now this letter seemed to her more terrible than anything she had been able to conceive. "He's right," she said. "Of course, he's always right. He's a Christian. He's generous. Yes, vile, base creature. No one understands it except me, and no one ever will, and I can't explain it. They say he's so religious, so high-principled, so upright, so clever. But they don't see what I've seen. They don't know how he had crushed my life for 8 years, crushed everything that was living in me. He's not once given thought that I'm a live woman who must have love. They don't know how at every step he's humiliated me and been just as pleased with himself. Haven't I tried, with all my strength to find something to give meaning to my life? Haven't I struggled to love him, to love my son when I couldn't love my husband? But the time came when I knew that I couldn't cheat myself any longer, that I was alive, that I wasn't to blame, that God has made me so that I must love and live. And now what does he do? If he'd killed me, I could have borne anything. I could have forgiven anything. But no, he... How was it I didn't guess what he would do? He's doing just what's characteristic of his mean nature. He'll keep himself in the right, while me, in my ruin, he'll drive still lower to worse ruin yet." She recalled the words from the letter. "You can conjecture what awaits you and your son." "That's a threat to take away my child, and most likely by their stupid law he can. But I know very well why he says it. He doesn't even believe in my love for my child, or he despises it, just as he always used to ridicule it. He despises that feeling in me, but he knows that I won't abandon my child, that I can't abandon my child, and that there could be no life for me without my child, even with him whom I love. But that if I abandon my child and run away from him, I should be acting like the most infamous, basest of women. He knows that, and knows that I am incapable of doing that." She recalled another sentence in the letter,
Our life must go on as it has done in the past.
That life was miserable enough in the old days. It has been awful of late. What will it be now?
And he knows all that. He knows that I can't repent, that I breathe, that I love. He knows that it can lead to nothing but lying and deceit. But he wants to go on torturing me.
I know him. I know that he's at home and happy in deceit, like a fish swimming in the water. No, I won't give him that happiness. I'll break through the spider-web of lies in which he wants to catch me, come what may. Anything's better than lying in deceit. But how? My God, was ever a woman so miserable as I am? No, I will break through it. I will break through it, she cried, jumping up and keeping back her tears. And she went to the writing-table to write him another letter. But at the bottom of her heart, she felt that she wasn't strong enough to break through anything, that she wasn't strong enough to get out of her former position, however false and dishonourable it might be. She sat down at the writing-table, but instead of writing, she clasped her hands on the table, and laying her head on them, burst into tears, with sobs and heaving breasts like a child crying. She was weeping because her dream of her position being made clear and definite had been annihilated for ever. She knew beforehand that everything would go on in the old way, and far worse, indeed, than in the old way. She felt that the position in the world that she enjoyed, and that had seemed to her of so little consequence in the morning, that this position was so precious to her that she would not have the strength to exchange it for the shameful position of a woman who has abandoned husband and child to join her lover. That however much she might struggle, she could not be stronger than herself. She would never know freedom in love, but would remain forever a guilty wife, with the menace of detection hanging over her at every instant, deceiving her husband for the sake of a shameful liaison with a man living apart and away from her, whose life she could never share. She knew that this was how it would be, and at the same time it was so awful that she couldn't even conceive what it would end in. And she cried without restraint, as children cry when they are punished. The sound of the footman's steps forced her to rouse herself, and hiding her face from him, she pretended to be writing. "The courier asked if there's an answer," the footman announced. "An answer?" "Yes," said Anna. "Let him wait. I'll ring." "What can I write?" she thought. "What can I decide upon alone? What do I know? What do I want? What is there I care for?" Again she felt that her soul was beginning to be split in two. She was terrified again at this feeling, and clutched at the first pretext for doing something which might divert her thoughts from herself. "I ought to see Alexei." So she called Vronsky in her thoughts. "No one but he can tell me what I ought to do. I'll go to Betsy's. Perhaps I shall see him there," she said to herself, completely forgetting that when she had told him the day before that she was not going to Princess Tverskaya's, he had said that in that case he wouldn't go either. She went up to the table, wrote to her husband, "I have received your letter, eh?" and ringing the bell, gave it to the footman. "We're not going," she said to Anushka as she came in.
"Not going at all?"
"No. Don't unpack till tomorrow, and let the carriage wait. I'm going to the princess's."
"Which dress will you wear?"